Just to introduce our presenter today, Brent Walker, who's probably known to most of, if not all of you. I think the best thing I could think of to say about Brent is he's got a wealth of experience in actuarial work in Australia over many, many years. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he once wrote a paper called Wealth Insurance. Is that right, Brent?
Yeah.
And that experience has covered the life insurance industry, the health insurance industry, and actuarial consulting in health insurance over many, many years. He's also chairman of the International Association of Consulting Actuaries, or was for a period in the early 2000s, and currently serves on the executive of the International Actuarial Association's health section. He's been appointed actuary to Life Insurers, Friendly Society, and currently acts in this role for two health insurers. So please welcome Brent to the podium.
Thanks, Peter. This presentation comes with sound effects, but I don't have any sound effects in the room, so... So I guess you're not going to hear all the explosions that are in it of the mines going off. which is a shame, actually, because I spent a bit of time getting some really good explosions in this. The paper came about in a rather strange way. My involvement in the global financial thing. Started a couple of years ago when I read some economists and Wall Street journals, and which were predicting that the credit markets were likely to freeze up. And I thought, well, gosh, I've got a couple of clients that are going to get affected by this, and one of them in quite a big way. So I sent them an email and said, look, you better get out of those damn CDO things that you've got and just get into bank bills. And of course, they said, you know, rubbish, and put it to their financial advisors who, you know, poo-poo the whole thing. So you can guess what happened to them. Anyway, when it really got going back in September last year, I thought, gosh, you know, this thing's really about moral hazard risk and the fact that everybody has just ignored it and ignored its effects. So maybe I should write an opinion piece for the Sydney Morning Herald or something. See, so I wrote one, but anyway, the editor didn't think it was a very good idea. I don't think it's very fashionable for papers to write on moral hazard risks. And I've tried several times, and in fact, for both the Fin Review and the Sydney Morning Herald, and didn't get anything in. And even one of my reporter friends rewrote one of my opinion pieces, thinking that maybe if he wrote it, it would be better worded, maybe the editor would accept it. Still, no luck. So then I thought, okay, I might write a paper on it. But I didn't tell the conference that I was writing a paper, because I didn't know what was going to come out of the end. So this is what's come out. The thing we have to understand is that moral hazard risk exists in pretty well all fields that we practice, and of course in management as well. And what I've tried to do is draw parallels between the moral hazard risks that we experience in traditional fields of practice and the credit finance industry. So I'm suggesting that, you know, part of some of the contributions to the global financial crisis are moral hazard risk and what I call regulatory arbitrage. So we need to understand what I mean by that. Insurance law around the world is based on the principle of abirma fide, which is utmost good faith. And if you enter into an insurance contract, which is just a contract about transferring risk, if you don't disclose all the risks to the other party, then you run the risk of having the contract cancelled, probably at the very time when you wouldn't like to have it cancelled. And that's the ultimate sanction that the law has for not disclosing risk in an insurance contract. So it enables life insurers, for instance, to cancel a contract after the death of the life insured, if the life insured died, from something that he should have disclosed to the life insurer, particularly if it happened in the early stages of the contract. Now, in the financial system, the law is based on caveat emptor. In other words, let the buyer beware. So the insurance law is based on utmost good faith. When you transfer risks in the financial world, it's buyer beware. And in fact, what's tended to happen is that the risks have not been disclosed when they've been transferred. And in my view, the solutions are regulatory ones, unfortunately, but not onerous regulatory ones. Government should look at removing some of the regulatory arbitrage that exists. In other words, try and base risk transfers that occur in the financial world more on a verum fide, in other words, utmost good faith, than they are based at the present time. And to do that, it needs better and more succinct disclosure. It's all very well having PDSs that are written by lawyers who have spent years training to write legal documents in the most obtuse language possible so that no one can understand them. Or having a mortgage document thrust at you which is nearly 100 pages long and you're expected to sign it without reading it. So one of the solutions, I believe, is succinct disclosure. And the second one is to utilise the principle which underpins so much of what we as actuaries understand, the principle of alignment of interests. And I'm suggesting a form of securitised credit products that are participating. In other words, the originator participates in the risk. Shauna was talking about this yesterday. This crazy system where one credit originator originates the credit and then shovels the whole of the risk off to somebody else. And in the securitised credit product market, of course, it's generally shifted to some pretty unsophisticated investors like my clients, like the councils all around Australia and the US. But of course, there are some sophisticated people that got caught out as well, such as the banks. So what is moral hazard? It's the prospect that a party insulated from risk may behave differently from the way it would have behaved if it had been fully exposed to the risk. So in other words, if you can get insulated from it, you might say, all right, well then I'll take on this risk. And I mean, that's exactly what happened in the United States in the mortgage market. The mortgage brokers couldn't have cared less what risks they were passing on to the credit underwriters. And the credit underwriters often couldn't care less either because they were passing the risk on to somebody else. So it is often related to information asymmetry, i.e. undisclosed essential information. It can be thought of as a party not entering into a transaction in good faith. So here's this utmost good faith business that comes through in insurance law. So we've talked about the legal concepts already, so I won't continue on with that. Now, the paper is about a whole lot of short stories. little fables sometimes, but actually all the stories in it are true, as far as I know. Most of them, I can vouch for about 90% of them, because they're things that have happened to me that I've actually, so they're actual stories that have occurred to me. There are one or two that have been suggested to me by other people who, you know, have just said, oh, you know, by the way, did you remember such and such? So the paper's about these little stories, and it's divided into looking at the moral hazard risks from the purchaser's side, from the provider's side, or the underwriter's side, and then usually from the point of view of reinsurance. And the reason why I've looked at the reinsurance side is because I likened the concept of securitising credit into, you know, breaking it up into small parcels and taking lots and lots of credit from different places and popping it all into one product and then slicing and dicing it, to a form of insurance, because in effect what you're doing is taking, you're aggregating a whole lot of risks and then disaggregating them. And you know, it's very, very like a reinsurance environment. And at the end of each section, there's some questions. The questions don't have answers, so this makes it a rather weird paper, because usually actuarial papers answer questions, but this paper only asks the questions. But the questions, of course, are loaded. So you probably can guess the answers. And the questions about life insurance. Oh, well, first of all, in life insurance, you know, most of the moral hazard risks created came from the mis-selling, often caused by fronting commissions not being disclosed. And in my very earliest days in life insurance, and this is, you know, within the first few months of actually working in a branch office of the AMP in Christchurch in New Zealand in 1964, I was thrown in the deep end in the little department that looked after the surrenders and loans. And the person who had run that department before me was a good mate. He was in one of the surf clubs, not the same surf club as me, but he was a good surfing mate and everything. He just suddenly up and left. And I ended up occupying his chair, and I'd get all these abusive phone calls, people that couldn't find out what their surrender value was, couldn't surrender their policies, couldn't borrow money, and I didn't have a clue what was going on. In the end, I found files everywhere, but many of them were hidden behind the safe. They'd been thrown there, because this poor guy, he just couldn't cope with the pressure, and he couldn't cope with all the abuse that he was getting from people who found out that the agent that sold them what they thought was a savings contract had taken the first 2 years premiums, and perhaps more, because some of it of course went to the management as well. I had to work my way through that, and that was when I discovered these what I called moral hazard mines that went off. And the reason why I call them a moral hazard mine was that if the agent had not told, well, very few agents told the insureds what the commission was, that would have been foolish, because they wouldn't have made the sale. But if the contract went for its full term, you know, usually until 95 or something in those days, if the person lived that long or until death, then that mine never went off. But if the person turned around and surrendered it after 5 years or 10 years, then you can bet that moral hazard mine blew up. And, of course, it wouldn't be the agent that copped it. It would be the person that was handling it. So that's why I called them moral hazard mines. The problem in combating or managing this particular moral hazard risk was competition. Because if you tried to change the commission term so that more of the commission was paid on a trailing basis, then the agents could turn around and leave you. And sometimes a whole group of agents would leave a life office. You know, sometimes a whole team and their manager would leave and go to another office. And then the next thing was they'd twist all the business that they had in the previous office, they'd tell those people to surrender their contracts with that office. It's no good. You know, that's why we moved to XYZ insurer, and you know, take out one with us at the XYZ insurer. So the risk from the competition made the management of the moral hazard risk embedded in the life insurance contracts very, very difficult, and actually needed regulatory involvement. But the regulators, of course, in those days were very slow to react. So the questions were, should there be better disclosure requirements or inducements of inducements or commissions payable to sellers of securitised credit products? Because that was one of the things that that was causing the sale of those credit products. Does the distribution channels change the moral hazard risk embedded in securitised credit products? In other words, if you change the distribution channels, the way these products were distributed, would you change the moral hazard risk? I didn't answer these questions. I think the answers are fairly self-evident. Now, I'm going to have to go through a lot faster than this, otherwise we won't end up with any time for questions. In the buyers of life insurance, I saw on several occasions where collusion between the agent and the insured occurred. Pretty easy for it to happen. You know, the insured would say when he was filling out the personal statement, I've had these terrible chest pains. Well, you better not tell the underwriter about those. Don't want him to get the wrong idea. Wrong idea for who? It certainly wasn't the right idea for the agent, was it? And it turned out it wasn't the right idea for the insured if he wanted to get his insurance. And of course, that moral hazard mine didn't explode if the insurer didn't die. If the insured didn't die in the next few years. But if he did, well, then of course, then it blew up. So the questions were: was there collusion between the credit originators and the credit purchasers as to the detriment of the investors of the, you know, that ended up with the risk? Of course there was. That was the problem. I mean, and that even happens in Australia in the low doc loan market, because a lot of low doc loans end up being securitised, and there is collusion that goes on. I've had personal. It's not in the paper, but I have had personal, well, not so much personal, but family experience of it. What effect would an appropriate disclosure regime have had if there, you know, there'd been full disclosure? Questions. The alignment of interest principle is important in life insurance. We talk about retention policies. The questions that come out of that are, should the alignment of interest principle apply in credit securitisation? In other words, should the credit originator retain some of the risk? Now, if there was laws in each country that says credit originators must retain at least 20% of the credit risk, do you think they would operate in the same way as they have? You know, it's a fairly simple law, and it would change markets amazingly. So how important is the essential difference between life reinsurance and securitisation, given that the reinsurance process aggregates risks and the securitised process eventually disaggregates it? It's an interesting question. For the buyers of general insurance, there's often no disclosure of financial interest of the intermediary. I can just recently I was in New Zealand and I hired a car, and part of the hire purchase, you know, the car hire agreement was that I was going to be responsible, I think it was for the first $2,000 or $2,500, I think it might have been, of any accident, any cost of accident. And then the person behind the counter said to me, and of course you realise that a lot of people in New Zealand don't have car insurance, So if you have an accident, and you know, you'll be up for not only your costs but the other person's costs as well, and it's, you know, and you'll be exposed for the full $2,500. I said, okay, so how do I get out of that? And they says, oh well, it will cost you $28 a day. Wow, $28 a day. That's about 30 times the premium that I ought to be paying, I think. But I still paid it. And just about everybody would, because, I mean, in the end, you don't want to have the hassle, if you do have an accident, of having to fiddle around settling the, you know, fixing up the claim and everything when you're back in Australia, even though that, you know, it was occurring over New Zealand. Now, did the person behind the desk at the hire car company tell me how much commission she was getting for that? I think she was very keen to sell it to me. So no doubt her boss was getting something, and she was probably getting something as well. So, you know, this was just a case. Maybe New Zealand's different than Australia, but, you know, the financial interest of the intermediary is often not disclosed, and it certainly wasn't in that case for me. Are purchasers of credit products advised of the commission payable to the intermediary that actually sold them, the broker? What about other commissions paid as the process occurs, where this piece of credit that you have obtained is aggregated with others and added to with credit default swaps and all the rest? What about all those credits? What about all those commissions that occur? Yeah, what disclosure occurs at this stage with all of those? And I don't think anything does, from what I can see. There's, in the paper, I've talked about some cases of absolute, you know, dreadful fraud that I've been aware of in workers' compensation. You'd be horrified when you read it. I won't go into it now. You know, this is a case of, you know, disclosure not occurring from the purchasers of the insurance. You know, one of the examples involved a union, and it was just unbelievable. But when you read it, then you will see that certain events that occurred on the waterfront in recent years, a few years ago, probably stemmed from this practice this union practice of ensuring that no more than 50% of the workers were off on workers' comp at any one time. Fascinating. Fascinating business in Australia. We also have the difficulty of providing insurance against something known in advance, and there is a paper on flood insurance in this conference. I haven't read it, and I don't think the paper was available when I checked the website, but that's something that I was talking about. So the questions are, how easy was it to perpetrate wholesale fraud and the ultimate underwriters of credit, given that they were generally unsophisticated investors? You know, this is the people that the councils in Australia that held the CDOs and the health funds and the pension funds. How easy was it to perpetrate wholesale fraud on those underwriters? And to what extent did deliberate untruths play a part? When we look at reinsurance, aggregation of risks is a very important issue for reinsurers, and reinsurers usually demand a lot of knowledge. You know, they need to know a lot about the risk before taking part on, because they need to ensure that they're not aggregating in such a way as to leave them very exposed. And quite often they have to continue to reinsure to ensure that that the risk is not aggregated in a way that's going to leave them very exposed, like FAI was after the Darwin cyclone. And counterparty risk is also very important in the reinsurance business. In other words, for both the insurer and the reinsurer, if it's passing risks further on, they need to be certain that the person they're passing the risk on to is going to be able to be financially secure and be able to pay up if they need to. So the questions were, would an insurer legally pass on products with embedded US subprime risks to a reinsurer without disclosing them? And of course the answer to that is no, an insurer couldn't have done that because it operates under a different legal structure, the Burma FIDE. Why did regulatory regimes fail to understand the information asymmetry between investors and insurers of the risk? And this puts it right back to the regulators. Why did regulators just not give a damn? You know, and that's not just in the US, but it's also in Australia. Was the counterparty risk of many credit default swaps ignored? In other words, why on earth did the industry let AIG get away with what they did? It's amazing. Would that have happened if AIG had been providing those credit default swaps in an insurance contract instead? And if so, why did the actuarial profession allow it? But why did the actuarial profession allow it anyway? Surely there must have been a lot of actuaries in AIG that knew exactly what was going on. Into the health insurance arena, disclosure is complex in the health insurance business, and it's complex because we have rules documents these days that are several hundred pages long, which are impossible to read by normal people, I guess, even though often they're still not written by lawyers, not in the same way as a mortgage document is. And then behind those rules documents, there are documents, contracts between the insurer and hospitals, and sometimes insurer and providers, and they're not visible to the insured. So the whole structure and the whole benefit structure has become incredibly complex. Now the government, to its credit in Australia, recognised this, and even though the industry was kicking and screaming and saying no, we don't want it, we don't want it, we got it. We got a key features statement. Key features statements are up on the web under privatehealth.gov.au, and every product that's sold in Australia has a key features statement. Hospital and general, ancillary product combinations have two pages, and hospital products one. Now it's quite an amazing achievement, and of course obviously there's going to be things left out of it, but at least there is a standard document for every product offered, and it can be viewed on the web. It's probably not used by people who are looking at buying a health insurance product as much as it should be, but it's certainly looked at by, of course, everybody in the industry. So it helps a peer review type arrangement, nothing else. The insurable, if the buyer is not the insured in health insurance, you can get insurable interests, issues. I won't go into it. And of course, in health insurance, the sovereign risk and market power issues are terribly important. The questions are, did sovereign risk play a part in the incorporation of moral hazard risk within credit products? Well, we know what Jimmy Carter's regime told the banking system about 20 years ago. Go and give money to the poor. You know, give the poor credit, particularly the blacks and the Hispanics and the poor whites. They need credit. And it just so happened that the banking industry were able to do this because they were just developing the securitised credit products at the same time. So that's why these things happened. If the banking industry had said, yes, we'll do that, you give us a guarantee, I think we would have had a different outcome. Could future moral hazard, sovereign moral hazard risk be averted by appropriately worded regulatory regimes? I don't know. But one would hope that governments should be able to set up regulatory regimes, like they have in Australia anyway, that are, where there's a lot less risk of government involvement corrupting the process. Would the concept of a key feature statement be useful in disclosing information to borrowers and investors? Now, I did pick up on something that Nick said today. He's got a copy of this paper, by the way. he did talk about that in the answer to one of the questions. So it's interesting. Maybe the government here is looking seriously at the concepts that we developed in health insurance. And I know the lawyers that developed it in health insurance are pushing it hard to be used in other regimes. Because that idea of a key feature statement really does get over a lot of disclosure problems. In health insurance, the insured invariably will modify his or her behaviour because of the insurance. But regulation can also modify it. And in health insurance, portability, in other words, the ability of changing from one fund to another without penalty, makes the competition between insurers reduce benefits for chronic illnesses. We have competitions almost in health insurance to get the benefits as low as possible for some things like psychiatric disorders, because otherwise you get all the psychiatric patients. If you have the best benefits, you'll get all the psychiatric patients, and it could just about break you, because there's only a few patients that take an awful lot of money. And so we by having a regime which allows you to move all of your to move from one fund to another to get better benefits also means that the funds have to have the lowest benefits to stop unwanted transfers coming to you. The other interesting thing that happens in health insurance is that unhealthy people usually don't withdraw. They may change from one fund to another to get a better benefit structure, but they don't withdraw from health insurance entirely. Now the questions, was the interaction of credit financiers in the US and their government similar to the interaction of Australian health insurers and their government? You'll have to read the paper to think about that one. Did the competition issues create additional moral hazard risk for credit issuers? In other words, if there was several credit brokers all trying to sell credit products to a market, and there was strong incentives to sell those credit products because of the commissions that were being paid, did the competition actually make it worse? Do credit risks deteriorate in time in the same way as health insurance risks? In other words, do the good payers end up paying off their credit faster and leaving the poor payers, you know, so that like in health insurance, the longer the contracts go, the worse risks the worse they become. Insurers that have been in the market a long time generally have poorer risks than new insurers. Does the credit market operate in the same way? I suspect it does. We have a claims equalisation system in health insurance, and the minimum retention is 18%. The maximum is much, much greater than that, because it depends on the size of the insurer. Should there have been a minimum risk retention requirement for credit originators? In superannuation, there's been mis-selling investment strategies to increase commissions. I'm referring particularly to not the Opus Prime, the mob up in Queensland. What were they called? Yeah, I was referring to them. But obviously, it probably occurs a lot. There's also there's an example in the paper of using a position of power to obtain advantage in the group life business. The use of subordination of function as well. You need to read the paper to understand some of these things. The questions are, was there mis-selling of credit? Did merchant banks and their rating agencies use their power for their own gain at the expense of the clients? Was there subordination of a function to the less experienced and ethical business practice? In other words, you know, if it's a complex function, should you be subordinating to somebody who doesn't really understand what's going on? And there is examples in the superannuation business where this occurs. What if in the process a subordinated deliberately hides the risks included in the subordination? Of course, that happened in the credit market. The paper then talks about the borrowers of credit. The professional specialisation leads to complex credit documents. Now, what I'm talking about is in every profession we're getting specialisation. In the actuarial profession, you know, the actuaries that specialise in health insurance as I do, other actuaries specialise in various other things. And, you know, we're getting a lot of specialties and subspecialties. But the more you get specialisation, the more you get complex documentation, particularly in the legal profession. And it gets to the point where you go to a lawyer with a mortgage document. He says, "I can't read that. You know, I haven't looked at mortgage documents for years. I wouldn't understand what they're talking about." You have to go to a specialist that knows about this. So it actually increases the costs when you get complex documentation. And that's why I believe simple disclosure documents are needed. I think if we can read through some of these. Should the borrower be told of any upfront profit or commission to be made by the seller? Should profits by any of the intermediaries between the seller and the eventual holders of the credit risk be disclosed? And if so, who should they be disclosed to? Should we have a disclosure regime that takes it all the way back down to the original borrower, or should there be some other disclosure regime? I don't know the answers to that, but you know, it's an important point, because in that market in the United States, everybody was making money on the way up as they securitised the thing, and added bits and pieces to it like credit default swaps. Everybody was making money. Now, surely, you know, somewhere along the line, there should have been disclosure. If the disclosure regime had been all the way down to the person who took the thing in the first place, would that have made a difference? Or should the disclosure be to some other, you know, perhaps to the end purchaser? You know, perhaps if the end purchaser of the credit security had a note that says, "Oh, by the way, you know, generally the commission paid on the loans was such and such, and the commission paid for this part of the securitised process was this, and the merchant bank got this much," and so on. You probably wouldn't have bought the security, would you? You look and said, "Well, who's paying for all this? Must be me." "No, thanks. I'm not going to." The important point I'm making is that if there had been proper disclosure and been in the right direction, possibly a lot of these things wouldn't have happened. If we had a loan that was provided and the original intention was to keep it on the books of the credit provider, but then the credit provider changed his mind and then shot it off to somewhere else. Should that be a point at where disclosure to somebody, presumably the person that got the loan in the first place, should that be should that information be provided, and if so, to whom? Because otherwise, you could very quickly subvert any disclosure regime by changing your mind after the key point in, at which you had to make the disclosure. The good old thorny question, are Australian low-doc loans and US subprime similar? A lot of people would say no, but by gosh, there was a lot of similar characteristics. And there still are, because we've still got low-doc loans in Australia, and they're still being sold. How much mis-selling of credit occurs in Australia? I don't know. To what extent will a credit supplier's considerations change if the intended credit was to remain was for it to remain solely on the books on the supplier, or wholly securitised, or somewhere in between? It's the question about the moral hazard risk right in the very beginning. Your intentions at the very beginning will dictate what kind of risks you're going to take. Well, you're not going to take, depending on the point of view. The ability of the applicant to pay the interest, including any after honeymoon rate. Would that have changed if you'd even considered it? Whether the applicant could pay the interest. It seemed from the reading, and there's a vast bibliography in that paper, that in many cases what the applicants for these mortgages were told was that when the honeymoon rate ends, you'll be able to refinance, get yourself another product with another honeymoon rate. So people thought, I'll only ever have to pay 2.5% or 3% or something per annum for this mortgage, because as soon as the honeymoon rate ends, I'll just refinance. Fascinating. Of course, the people that were buying the insecurities weren't told that. Had there been a mandatory credit retention requirement, would the excesses that did occur still have occurred? And I think the answer to that is obviously no. What if the retention requirement had originated from central business practice? In other words, what if the rating agencies had said, well, if you're going to pass 100% of the risk onto something else, we're going to give it a BB rate right from the word go. But if you're going to retain at least 20% of the risks yourselves, then we'll give it an A rating of some kind. Looking at management, and there's some examples in the paper about management by objectives. There's a wonderful apocryphal story that goes around actuarial circles in the United States concerning an actuarial practice leader that required each subordinate actuary to bill 6 hours extra per week. That was his instructions. His instructions weren't go out and work 6 hours extra a week, but you had to bill 6 hours more a week. And then there's a consultant that I know that regularly billed more than 200 hours a week. And I'm not going to give you his name. It's not an Australian. It doesn't work in Australia. There's another wonderful example in there of a management that I was involved with that fudged figures to get their KPIs. I didn't like it when my report drew attention to it, and I got retired. The rating agencies that get paid for providing a rating, but are immune from the legal process arising from the incorrect ratings. I might just go back.
Are you going to start wrapping
okay,
up?
Okay, well, I won't go back. So we're on to the conclusions. The moral hazard risk occurs when there's information asymmetry. An insurance legal requirement is utmost good faith, but that does not apply when risks are transferred outside the insurance environment. And the antidotes are to moral hazard risk of disclosure, the alignment of interests, contractual parties, and usually a combination of regulation and management that's required to make these antidotes work. And that's the end. More conclusion, sorry. The key features statement that I talked about on health insurance was a useful tool for disclosure. I believe it would be a useful tool for disclosure of credit information because the environments are similar. Rather large, complex documents behind the information that a person has provided. Participating securitised credit products will restore trust to credit markets, but they would also enable existing products to be rolled over, because what people, what everybody's worried about at the present time is that the CDOs have still got on their books and are still paying interest, but you can't sell. At the end, when the thing needs to be rolled over, it won't be able to be rolled over because there won't be another product. It won't be. Nobody will want to buy the new product. But if the new product was a participating product, then there's a fair likelihood that the market would be started up again. So it's just looking at one way of getting the world out of the pickle that it's in. And that would enable credit availability to be sensibly expanded. And in my view is that government should address regulatory arbitrage. That's the end of the paper. Now, I would like you all to actually read the paper, because it's the stories in there that that make you realise where all the questions that are in there come from, and the statements that are in there, which are a bit bored by themselves.
Are there any burning questions? Maybe just one quick one from anyone, or...? I'd like to make an observation. I think that Brent's done a fantastic job here, and I think I do commend the paper to you. I think if we could just do, or if we could have underwriting of credit risk in the way we understand it in life insurance and general insurance, I don't think we would have had the global financial crisis. That's in one sentence what I take away from this paper, and I'd like you all to thank Brent for his paper.